Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep. Well, welcome everybody to another one of our professional guide series. This is the idea of this is to talk about things that matter to guides. So if you're a private boater or a kayaker, we'd love to have you listen. But like everything about this is in the context of river guiding. And what I'm doing here is sharing a presentation I've been working on based on a questionnaire that I did to get basically what I think is best practices. And the goal is to do a presentation on this. I mean, not just a goal. I'm going to do a presentation at the America Outdoor Show in December. So this is sort of like a dry run of that and to get Aaron and Mark's feedback. And I brought Aaron and Mark on because they are two like insanely experienced river guides. Both of them have guided for like 30 years, more than 30 years. I mean, we have 90 years of experience between us here. Like not just 90, like I guided 1 year, then guided 20 years later. Like these two guides have worked pretty much every season for the past 30 years as a guide. And, you know, Aaron's worked on like things like the Cherry Creek and the Food La Foo and the Grand Canyon, Selway, day trips, like worked internationally. And Mark is an international man of mystery who travels the world guiding all over the world, but more than that, like teaching both rescue and river guiding skills in schools and IRF courses to river guides all over the world. So I feel like with the two of them, I have two diverse experienced opinions to have these conversations with. And you guys haven't seen this yet. This is a presentation. This is data you guys are seeing for the first time. So did I get your introductions correct? Do I need to add anything?
You're going to introduce
yourself. Still just a raft guide at the end of the day.
We're all raft guides. We're all river guides. That's what we are. We're river guides who really care about the industry. And in a lot of ways, like we all care about improving it and making it better. So let's get started and go through this. First of all, when I first presented this questionnaire to guide, I sent this questionnaire to guides, outfitters, rescue professionals. Some of them said, oh, you don't want this data to get out because we could be liable for having best practices. We don't want to have these conversations. I got that from a few people.
Really?
And I don't agree with that. We should talk about what best practices are. We should share what we think and opinions. And I'm also reading this book, Beneficial Risks, that I think you guys, if you haven't read it, you might enjoy. It's sort of a modern take on risk. And it makes the point that best practices are not formal standards. Formal standards are set by organizations. Like ACA could set formal standards. IRF could set formal standards. American Outdoors could set formal standards. They don't. But best practices are just kind of like, what is everybody else doing? And the quote below is from the book, which I really like. I'm not going to read it to you guys, but I think it's okay to talk about best practices for those of you that are worried about that.
Well, I think that quote says it all, right?
Yeah.
Just because you don't, if you keep your whatever, your head in the ground and you keep just don't look at what else is out there, that doesn't make you not responsible. You should be paying attention to what's going on in the industry.
Yeah. And so I'm trying to congregate what the industry thinks and sharing that with the industry, which is sharing best practices. I'm going to share my opinion in here. And I probably shouldn't, but I'm going to. And not all the time, but I will share my opinion. You guys should share your opinions too. And just as a reminder, I mentioned this already. This is about river guides, professional river guides. So some of this stuff applies to private boaters, but this is a conversation about guides.
I'm going to say this though, Zach. This is something, and maybe we've been a little, I think we diverge here a little bit. I feel like even if you're not a commercial river guide and you're taking your friends down, you kind of still have the same responsibility because your friends don't know what they're doing. They're just coming with you because they trust you. And like, yeah, you're not a commercial river guide, but it doesn't mean you aren't exposing people to the same risks.
It's true.
And you don't have to, I feel like, so in my mind, a lot of ways, I think everyone should, even if you're not working professionally, if you're taking people down the river and you're running the river, you should be trying to obtain that level of knowledge. If that makes sense.
The same duty of care.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well said.
I agree. I guess the reason I'm saying this is because I'm happy to go on tangents with people who in the comments who are guides. I'm not going to go into private boater tangents. Like that's not what this is about. So I agree with you guys on that. But if you're a private boater and you're listening or watching, like please comment, but I might ignore it because I really want to have a conversation about river guides. right now. But I get that's a good point. This is the slide I've been thinking about a lot, and this one is a little bit much. And when you know they teach you to give PowerPoint presentations, they say don't make slides like this. But I'm trying to make the point here, and it could be more here. Mark saw this yesterday, this slide, and he said, "Oh, add this and this." I'm like, "That's true," but my idea is that private boaters, guides, and kayakers should be learning whitewater rescue, which is like you're in the river already, you're dressed for the river in PPE. The people you're rescuing are also boaters generally, and they're also dressed in PPE, and you're moving down the river. Swift water rescue to me denotes you're on the riverbank, you're a professional rescue, whether you're a firefighter, a search or rescue, whatever. You're approaching a scene from the bank and rescuing victims that are not river people that are not dressed in PPE that may not be able to help in any way. And so I think those are two totally very different types of rescue. And I think my opinion is they require different classes, different teaching. And within those types of rescue, for the swiftwater side, there's like field workers and agencies and first responders who might need different training. And the whitewater side, there's private boaters, guides, and kayakers. Where there's some overlap, I just want to make the point that they are different. And the core of it all is swimming, knots, and throwing throw bags. I feel like those are core, like, rescue techniques. And then beyond those, and those are the basics. Mark yesterday said, well, wading is as well, which that's true. I took it out of private rafters, but that was maybe dumb. If you can see where I put it here. But just this is my attempt to say, hey, it's rescue should be different for different people. Any thoughts about this, guys?
Most of it makes sense. I'm just confused by the prevention and chain of command only.
Well, I think like private boaters need more prevention because they just don't learn it. Like we all need it, but private boaters don't go to guide school. They don't get that. Well, they just have none of that. So they need a lot of prevention. And they also don't get chain of command. There's not like a lot of times like a trip leader. So like talking about leadership is important to everybody, but it's really important to private boaters who have zero of that.
Okay.
That's my thinking.
Yeah, no, I understand a little bit better. Yeah, the chain of command, that makes sense. The prevention, I could see arguing you need a lot more work with that with private rafters and those, but it's a good thing for all to discuss. But yeah, I got you. Yeah.
You want it everywhere, but I'm really tripling down on private boaters.
Well, and you're also just talking about where you're going to emphasize your time. If you're teaching a course to private rafters, you're going to spend a lot of time on prevention, chain of command stuff versus, you know, kayakers. You spend a lot of time on kayak rescue and kayak pins. Which you wouldn't do any other. So, yeah.
And you probably won't talk about raft pins in a kayak course. I mean, it doesn't hurt kayakers, but my thing about teaching rescue too is like you have a limited time and I'm trying to not make this about rescue, about like training river guides in particular. You have a limited time. Where are you going to focus your time? And then if you have extra time, you can go bigger, but where should you really be focusing your time?
Yeah. Okay. I totally agree. There's a diminishing, you only have so much time. Yeah. What's going to have the greatest impact with that time?
Mark,
I think the art of being a good, and you know, we approach this as instructors, I think the art of being an instructor is really finding out from your students, you know, what their needs and motivations are when you are going to be teaching. For instance, if you have students that work on a big volume, non-technical river, you're going to spend less time teaching pin boats and more time on swimming and throw bags. And, you know, just to determine between the difference in my mind in whitewater rescue and swiftwater rescue, when we're whitewater rescuing with guides, everything is happening in front of us and it's dynamic. We're potentially going to have somebody moving down a river. So we're going to use one set of rescue tactics. Whereas a swiftwater rescue, like you said, Zach, is a bank-based rescue and a responder is going to get onto the scene. Maybe when somebody's stuck on top of a car, somebody's stuck on top of a rock or in a place and they're static and they're no longer moving. So they're using a different set of rescue tactics again.
Yeah. Yeah. I like all that. This slide isn't perfect. This is just my way to like put on paper what's in my head. And I think the important thing is a lot of rescue classes that are taught now are taught to all of these groups at the same time. There's like, we're doing a rescue class and there's participants from all of these groups. And if it's taught by somebody who is like, let's say a first responder, they're teaching more of their knowledge base and what they're good at than what the people might need. So if you're a river rafter taking a class from somebody who's a first responder, you're not going to get the things that make you safer.
And they're not going to, and if there's a mixture of people, they're going to be spending a lot of time on stuff that is irrelevant.
Yeah. To the other groups. Yep. I could go on and on about what's irrelevant, but let's move on.
I just feel like we've all taken those courses. We've been all been in there with helicopter pilots who say, well, just use the helicopter to rescue. And you're just like, wait, what? You know, like it has nothing to do with our reality pretty much. Yeah. So, yeah.
So this next thing is I think about a lot in how we teach is that we're always asking for alignment and not necessarily agreement. But what I see currently in a lot of the rescue classes from what I hear from students and talk to instructors about is that we're not aligned. We're on the left. People are saying opposite things. Oh, if a raft pins, use a vector pole. Other people say, use a 3-to-1. You know, always do this. Never do that. And there's not alignment. And I think what we need as a river guide training industry is more alignment. We don't have to be perfectly agreed on things, you know, but we should all be pointing in the same direction. And I feel like instructors are telling people opposite things. And what I'm finding, instructors are telling people things that are just like wrong, just straight up wrong. And so
according
I want
to Zach.
I mean, okay, Aaron, do you use a dynamic line for your pin kit?
No.
When you're a river guide, do you only swim aggressively?
No.
These are things rescue instructors are telling students. There's more. I have a list of them.
Are you sure that's what they're actually telling them, or that's just what people are hearing?
No, I know they're. I know that. Okay. I could go on about this, but there are things that are like actually wrong being told. Instructor told one of my river guides a vector pole is 10-to-1. So like things like that. Now that one I haven't corroborated that one, but I don't see the river guide making that one up. But my goal, I think that as a guide training industry, or we need to be more aligned, and that's kind of the goal of sharing best practices is working towards alignment. We don't have to agree 100%, but we should be aligned. So the survey I did, I got 158 responses from a variety of people. There was a lot from the US, but there were some from Europe and Asia responding. I tried to get global reach on this and got a good variety of people. And I thought I did some looking at the data. I thought the owners and managers and guides and instructors might have vastly different answers, but they were like all, it wasn't as different as I thought it would be. So that's the respondents. And I just want to get into some of the questions and the responses. And the first one is about what PPE, what even PPE means. Like, what does it include? And I think I started with like, it should be definitely a PFD, definitely cold water protection, definitely shoes, definitely a whistle. But what else would you guys include in PPE?
Well, the knife, the river knife. Mm-hmm. That seems like, yeah, which is high up there. That's interesting. I'm amazed that flip line is so low.
So flip line wasn't, you had to write that in. Everything below throw bag were write-in answers. Some questions I allowed to write in, some ideas, usually a bunch of random stuff.
Okay, that makes more sense about the flip line then. Okay.
So I'm gonna move on for a second. I'm gonna share now my opinion. I think we should be dividing things into PPE and the term that Mark introduced to me, PRE, personal rescue equipment. So PPP like protects you.
Yeah.
Which I feel should actually include a CPR mask. And PRE, rescue equipment, is throw bag, flip line, mechanical vantage system if you want to have that on your own. And if you choose to have a rescue harness under PFD. Is this in line with Mark, what you've been teaching?
Yeah, that's I've been teaching that for a year now. And depending on where you're based in the world, the style of river that you're running, the needs of the operation you're in, you can adjust that PRE equipment, you know, to location specific to where you're teaching and where you're working.
So Mark, what stuff like would you add, subtract from this list depending, just to get
an idea? So for instance, I used to work for Queenstown Rafting in New Zealand years ago, and each guide we would say that we would have to carry 4-3-2-1, 4 carabiners, 3 pulleys, 2 prussics, and a flip line, a knife, and a throwback, because their shot over river in low water is a very pinny river where boats get pinned. So the guides have got to carry that themselves. Whereas then you go to another river in the same area, which is the Cowra, which is a bigger volume river where you've not got that much opportunity to pin. Do I necessarily need to have that stuff on me, on my body, on person? Or am I going to carry it in a dry bag in the boat with me? Because the chance of me having to use it is a lot lower. Again, am I on a river trip where I have to carry my own pulleys and prussics in my PFD, or am I working for a company, or am I working in a country where it's law that every boat must have a wrap kit inside the boat in a dry bag? So I'm just tweaking, you know, as to the river and the environment that I'm operating in.
That's interesting. Do you really feel that you need to have like pulleys, prussics, and carabiners like on your body?
Again, depends on the river we were working in. The shot over river in Queenstown, you know, it's hard to move up and down the bank. You're working in a flotilla of maybe 20 boats, and out of that you would have maybe 3 boats that have a designated wrap kit in them. And for whatever reason, if you can't get access to those 3 boats and you need to start to get, you know, a mechanical advantage system on, or you need that pulley and you need that equipment, and you can't get access to those boats, you know, it's going to be a bad day in the office. So by having that on you yourself in person, definitely helps.
Just to clarify, when you say on person, like if I have a little personal dry bag clipped in next to me, do you consider that the equivalent, or do you like it needs to be in a pocket on your life jacket?
I mean, I personally, if I'm happy with it in my boat next to me. If I'm trip leading and I know the river I'm working on, I know my lines, I know the chances that I'm going to need that kit, maybe in a dry bag next to me. If I'm going onto a river that I don't know, a river that I know is technical and hard, I might get separated from my boat. It might be my boat that's pinned, then I might carry it on me. But again, you've then got the issues of, well, and this is something you see when you get a lot of students that turn up to do a course, and you see the amount of rescue equipment they've got inside their PFD, and you're like,
exactly.
Is that a personal flotation device, or is it a PPE carrying device?
No, that's what I was kind of curious about when you were talking about, like on your person. I was like, man, for me, I'm like hesitant. I'm like, I want the least amount on me. Like, I want my knife on me for sure, and I want my whistle on me, and then I want my flip line on me. And I can see an argument for the throw bag depending on where I am. But other than that, I prefer, in general, I prefer to have it accessible. If everyone has one on their boat accessible, I'm not too concerned, you know. I'm like,
depending on where you work. A little bit, because on the Middle Fork or the Rogue, we don't have one on every boat. We just have one in the last boat. Like a super, so I think it's a little river dependent. Like I don't feel like every boat has to have a 3-to-1. We don't do that in the U.S. hardly at all. Usually one boat, maybe two, has a pin kit. Not every boat.
Yeah, but I mean, if you have just one boat with the pin kit, then that boat wraps.
Oh, I know. Go ahead, Mark. Sorry to interrupt you, Mark.
I think so we've got to look at as well is that we're all looking at this from a first world perspective. I've taught in countries where, you know, you can't go onto the streets and buy pulleys and carabiners stuff. And I also think as well that we put so much pressure on people having this kit, and you get people turning up on courses and they have the kit and they don't know how to use it. They don't know how to use it. So in my mind now, it's, are you carrying this equipment, but do you also know how to use the equipment if it's the equipment you're carrying or the kit that the company's providing in that wrap kit, which is in whichever position, in whichever boat it is on the trip.
We have a lot to cover. I'm going to move on. I just want to make the point that I feel like a CPR mask should be a part of PPE. I feel like if you learn about drowning, and we'll talk about drowning a little bit, like I think a CPR mask is just every guy should have one. Even the little tiny ones that are like cost 30 cents.
You just put them in a pocket. They take up.
They cost $2 on River Hardware, yeah. Or 25 cents if you buy 100 of them.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it makes sense. I don't care if you carry PPE or PRE. I think you can make arguments for both, but having that on your body in a pocket makes a ton of sense. Yeah.
This just goes back. Like, there's no, like, if you look at this question, like, there's no solid agreement other than, like, you can see, like, most people would say helmet, river knife, and throw bag. I don't consider throw bag as a protective piece of equipment. I consider it a rescue equipment. So I'm trying to break this up in the terminology that Mark uses. I really like PPE and PRE, and throwing throw bag in that.
Yeah.
Okay. River knives. Go ahead.
Going back for a second.
Yeah.
No, to the other one. The PFD rescue harness. Are we going to talk about that more later or?
No, I can't remember if it comes up, but we're not going to talk about it later.
Then I would just say is like, I
know what you're going to say. I agree with you 100%.
I feel like all the other stuff on there. Yep. Everything else I see up there. Yes. The PFD rescue harness. I think it like insults the rest of it, having it in the same group. It doesn't belong with the rest of them. I feel like it should be like down at the bottom in really small print. Maybe. I don't know. And Mark, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. You've worked a lot more environments I have. I just feel like I don't really see the purpose of it. You know, I've heard about a couple of places, but I don't know. Go ahead.
I'll be quick, and you know, we could have this conversation all day. Is that when we talk about a PFD rescue harness, we often think of the context of the person wearing the harness is the rescuer, and they're going to use the rescue to use the harness to perform a rescue. And yes, that is what 90% was used. What we always also forget is that if you have a fellow guide or a kayaker on the river and they become entrapped, if they're wearing a PFD with a rescue harness on, you are making your life a lot easier because you are able to clip a line. So let's say you've got somebody trapped against a strainer. You can then use that harness. You can clip a line into the back of that harness and pull the person off a lot easier. So yes, we can use the rescue harness when we're working as rescued, but if I'm wearing a harness and I'm entrapped, that harness is also aiding my personal rescue. So that's another way of looking at the rescue harness PFD.
So it should almost be over on the PPE side, not on the PRE side.
Yeah, for me personally, yeah.
I mean, okay. But Mark, you're saying 90% rescuing others, 10% being rescued. So like it still is something that's used to rescue others.
Yeah.
10% is to be saved yourself.
Mean, it's not necessarily rescue others, but it's a way of, I mean, no, it's actually, no, let me go back and correct myself on that. It's, you know, that the harness is used, you use it as a rescue tool to go and rescue others. So not just for that, you know, that classic life bait swim, but attaching a line to you might be working in poor visibility or something. And then the harness can also be used when your friends have to come and rescue you to clip on and be rescued with.
I'm gonna put an opinion out here and say this, and then you guys can tell me I'm totally wrong on this. I just feel like when I see people with those, I think they're big tools.
You're right.
But like, I think they don't know how to use them. Well, they spend all this extra money on this thing that is pretty much has no purpose for them. And they've got a low float life jacket with their rescue harness for rafting versus a high float life jacket, which would be like, in terms of choice, would I rather see someone in a high float life jacket without a rescue harness or in a little Astral kayak vest on a high volume river? I mean, it seems like a no brainer to me.
I agree with you, Aaron. So when you start talking, like, I already know where you're going. We're going to agree on this.
I agree.
I feel like my needle has moved a little bit on this in like teaching classes with Mark and seeing how we've used it in teaching people to help get people that are foot entrapped. Like there is some use there, but like, I'm going to say almost everybody has them now. because they're almost ubiquitous. Any good PFD just has one. And so they're, everybody just has them already. And when I put it on this list, it was a, it was in response to how much it showed up here. Like the list of villains is like probably 30 long. You're only seeing like 10 of them. But I'm like, okay, well, if it's going to live somewhere, it's going to be PRE.
Yeah.
And I would say PRE is kind of like stuff that like rescue squirrels have. I call everybody should have a flip line, a throwback.
But are we going to talk about food entrapments later more?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. Yeah, let's keep going.
Okay, let's move on. River, this one's easy. River knives. I feel like some people like, so you have to have them externally mounted. But I mean, it looks like 65% of people say, hey, your choice, your call. So I'm glad. I was happy to see this.
I mean, that's about, that's, you know, that's about as much of agreement as you can get on any topic, I think, is 64% agreeing. Like, that's a pretty incredible percentage to agree.
Yeah. Mechanical advantage is a primary technique for removing rafts and pins. They, you know, Aaron, if you read the responses, a million people are like, other techniques are better, blah, blah, blah. Your favorite thing, like, tube deflation. Which, let me just take an aside. I just got a really nice email from a fan of the show who had a wrap on the middle fork and they used tube deflation and it worked. And they said, thank you for making all those videos about tube deflation. very nice team. No ropes. They just tube deflated and it came off. So
yeah, totally. It's amazing. It's a magic.
But the question is the primary mechanical advantage technique. Yeah, totally. So people didn't read the question and then put these weird answers. But I feel like this is a big thing to me is I feel like a lot of rescue instructors are giving up on 3-to-1 and teaching only vector pull.
Really?
Yeah, and if you read through all the answers, you'd be like, "Are you kidding me?" Like, there are rescue instructors who are like vector pull, but I the point of this question is show like the
have those rescue instructors ever used it to get wraps off?
They a lot of them say they have, or like we heard about a time. They all have a reason for this. I'm trying to figure out the reasoning. But I want to make the point that, like, if we look for alignment, it's going to be most people are saying 3-to-1.
3-to-1. I think there's some advantages, some of the other ones, and people talk about them, and I respect some of their opinions on it. And I think if you're really smart and you, like, want to dive into it and you want to know a different one, that's fine. Just don't expect everyone else to know how to do it and just know how to do a 3-to-1 as well.
Okay. Can I just add some here on this side? Go into what you said and go out on a limb here. I would say that the bulk of modern day rescue instructors are coming from a day raft, paddle raft background, where if a boat gets pinned, you've not got that much kit in it, and maybe it would come off with a vector. I think a lot of rescue instructors are probably not coming from the background of multi-day trips with a boat, with a frame and full of kit. Me personally, when I teach, it's, you know, give it a strong arm pull. We'll try a vector. If a vector doesn't work, then we'll go into a mechanical advantage. But I would never teach a vector over mechanical advantage anytime.
I kind of want to see these instructors like have produce a video of them actually show me like it working like in a video, you know, of like a boat wrapped and how you did it, because it just seems messy.
Show me a vector on an 18-foot fully loaded boat and show me how that works.
Because the vector pull to work, you need to be like in the middle of the line. You can't be like really close to the anchor on one end. It's not going to do anything, right? You got to be like halfway in the middle, out in the river.
I'm going to interrupt real quick because we have some slides about the vector pull. So we can so we're already going to go down this path already because this is so frustrating to me. I would say like my take is for the, and I think this Aaron would agree. If you're a day trip guide and you have to deal with the wrap, like tube deflation, I mean, it's tube deflation and strong arm pull is going to get almost every day trip wrap off. Like, that's what I would shoot for. So, like, when you look at who chose, this is one where there was a big difference. Like, 22% of guides and 22% of owners said this, 14% of managers. And then, if it's a river guide instructor, it was 17%, and non river guide instructors, 50%.
He just can't clarify non-river guide instructors.
I asked, who are you? Are you a river guide? Are you a river manager? Are you an owner? Are you a rescue instructor that instructs guides? or are you a rescue instructor that does not instruct guides?
Emergency services responders. Okay.
Okay. So the non-river guide instructor, Zach, but what's your sample size on that? Is it like two people one?
No, it's probably 8 or 10. Okay, it's actually still decent. I wouldn't have put this if the sample size was 2. It's bigger than 2.
8.
It's not huge. It's not. This isn't science.
Yeah.
But this is a general.
It's giving us a feel for it. No, I think. Yeah, but you know, it's interesting that owners and guides are higher than managers.
Yeah.
And then river guide instructors are lower. That's interesting that percentage of river guide instructors also say to do that as the primary.
Yeah. And what was surprising is both single and multi-day were about the same.
Like, you know what would have been a great follow-up question? Have you ever used this technique for an actual rep?
That's a good idea.
Successfully.
A rescue instructor was telling me that they used what's that fancy thing called again, Mark? The voodoo hitch? The transport hitch. To get a sweet boat that was unstuck. They're like, I use a transport hitch to do it. So transport hitches are awesome. I drove sweep for a long time. I've never used a rope once. So my point would be like, you could have also gotten it off with nothing. Like, a transport hitch did not save the day. But anyway.
What I have seen work, Zach, is an external mechanical advantage system originally used to pull, and then the external mechanical advantage system taken off and attached to another anchor, and then that external MA system is made tight and tensioned to create a vector.
I've done that too, but you started with a 3-to-1. You basically cranked on it with a 3-to-1 or some system, and then you did some vectoring and it made a little bit of a difference.
Yeah.
The arrows here are for me to indicate like this is a place where we don't have alignments. We have 20% of the people saying something that's different. And it's problematic to me because some people are learning something and some are learning something else. And when you're in the field, we're being taught two vastly different techniques. And so some things about vector pulls. I've done the math. It's at best 3-to-1. Just everybody knows. It's not 10-to-1. With low stretch rope, if you have high stretch ropes, it's not very good. Anytime you make any movement of the boat, an inch or two, the mechanical advantage goes way down, like almost to 1-to-1, or it can be lower than 1-to-1 with the vector pull. So that's cool. You can move it 2 inches, 3 inches, but all your mechanical advantage is gone. So it's only good for a very short distance.
You got to retighten the line. And,
and it's really – and so that's – and people say, well, do progress capture a vector pull. I can't make progress capture work. It's like, show me
like that's, I think these people who are saying this, show us and talk about all these wraps you've taken care of in this manner. Yeah. So,
and I think, the reason people are pushing vector pulls, I think, is because it keeps people out of the line of fire. You're not going to get stuff firing back at you and hurting you. I think that's a reason why it's been pushed so hard. It's simple. It's very easy, but I also feel like people have overestimated the mechanical advantage of vector pulls. They like do their thing where people pull on two ends of a rope and with one finger, they make them all move, which is really cool to show people, but it's not how like it works in the real world. It's not that easy.
Zach, my thought is this, is that if you teach that, your liability is really low, right?
That's true. Yeah.
And that's probably why they teach it. It's not because it's good, because it covers their butts.
Maybe.
Like you're talking about gear recovery at this point, and let's just not get anyone else hurt. And so in a lot of ways, it makes sense to do that early just because it is low risk, But as we agree, I don't think it works very well, but you're not really, it's going to be hard to hurt somebody on shore. Now, someone coming downstream with the lines out there, that's a different story, but maybe that's,
It's true. And Mark and I blew D-rings this spring. And if you see D-rings blow off a raft and fire back, you will be scared to death of it. It is terrifying. But there's things you can do. You can do a 3-point anchor. You can put dampening on the system. You can do a redirect. Like there's things you can do to mediate.
You can go around
the tubes, which we did a bunch of that. We blew the floor out, but that was fun. And the case I want to make for 3-1 is it's the progress capture is built in. It's easy. I think that's a huge advantage of 3-1. You can ratchet your system. It's the commonly used technique that people know. We don't have to change everybody's opinion. We're going to get alignment. And like I said, with a 3-point anchor, a dampener, and or a redirect, it can be done responsibly. It just requires those.
The key thing for me when I'm teaching dealing with pin boats, when I'm teaching, you know, do we use a vector or a mechanical advance? I mean, that stuff's all good. But I think the key thing to get over is the direction of the pull. Is making sure the students are getting the right direction of pull before they start to apply a vector or an MA system.
Yeah.
Get the angle right. Angle first. Yep.
Get your angles right and learn your angles. Get your angles right first. Yep.
So, two things on this. Going back to Zach's original, we spend a lot of time on this, but there's all this stuff before we get to the vector pool or the 3-1.
Yeah.
That we can, and I think that's the big thing is don't get to that spot. And I don't think most don't need to get to that spot. If the people do, you know, people know, you know, when you're navigating the boat, don't hit it sideways, turn and hit your nose on it. If you do, call an over before you hit it, you know, all these things, to these preventative things, and to practice those skills.
Preventative stuff. And
I see a lot of people don't know how to teach a good over, a good high side, where they go off of the upstream tube and just down into the well of the boat, which helps some. But if you got all your weight on that downstream tube and really push it down the water, make it more like a kayak and pivot that upstream tube up. And so I feel like this is a classic where I'd way rather spend a lot of time on that, you know, and teach that. And then say, like, okay, here, if you get to this point, here's a 3-1, note a 3-1 versus talking about, well, learn a vector pull and learn a 3-1 and learn all these other stuff. It's like at this point, just have a method with ropes that's going to work and spend most of your time talking about this stuff before you get a rope out.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to move on. We have a lot to do. These are some photos of wraps. I just want to make the point, like, vector pulls aren't going to work on some of these. Probably all of these. Like this is what an actual wrap looks like. Not like a paddle boat sort of stuck on some shallow rocks. Like, this is when you need to pull out the heavy duty firepower, which a 3-1 is like there's heavier duty firepower than 3-1. It's just like a good solid. And all of these wraps, 3-1s worked. Like, they did the job. A couple of these, it had 2 3-1s the same time, but there's no way a vector pull, except for the upper right hand corner one. That was just a easy flat wrap. But like, a vector pull is just not going to work on this stuff. All right, raft anchors. When attaching a rope to a raft using D-rings, and Aaron, I know you're going to say go around the tube, but 70% are saying 3 D-rings should be the standard. I love hearing that. I was a 2 D-ring guy. My 2 D-rings is good enough until Mark and I blew some D-rings last spring, and we watched 2 D-rings break at the same time a few times. So I feel like we should be doing 3 D-rings. Any thoughts about that?
Your angles, you know, having a long enough piece of webbing to do 3 D-rings. I think that's my concern. If I were teaching this, I would be concerned about that with students, is understanding how, you know, this angle, it gets too wide and you're increasing the load, not decreasing it. And
So 30 feet, that's the number. You need a 30 foot piece of webbing to pull off a 3-point anchor.
Let's think about, like, how long is your bow line normally? I mean, you're talking almost a bow line right there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I teach a lot of it, especially because I work with a lot of day rafters, they don't use bound stern lines because they can't store it properly on a boat, which is another conversation. But, you know, I teach your bow or your stern line should be a minimum, a length and a half of the boat, which is then going to give you enough rope to do a 3-point anchor, and then also to use for an internal MA system. So if you want to tackle the boat up, if it's pinned and doing it that way. So it's another thing that you can add in.
All right, moving on. When attaching to an anchor on land, like a rock or a tree, 51% say the wrap 3-2 pull 2 should be the gold standard. I'm going to give my opinion here. I'm going to share my opinion. I'll let you guys dive into my opinion. I've seen people in the real world forget how to do the wrap three pull too. And every wrap I've ever been a part of, just a one wrap around a tree or rock has been plenty strong.
Single point.
I want to get complicated here because I think 3D rings is really important, but I don't think we need to get complicated on a tree or a rock. I think we can go with a simple wrap around something, and I think that's fine. A wrap three pull two is cool. It's bonus points, but I feel like Mark and I watched somebody who was teaching it last year and teaching it wrong because even a instructor couldn't remember how to do it correctly. So I would keep it simple.
I think what happens here, Zach, is a lot of people just regurgitate what their instructors will tell them. And yes, mm-hmm. The wrap three pull two is it's got four legs. So it's strong. Yeah. You've got no tension on your knot. It's great. If you've got a piece of webbing long enough, if you're in a country that's got trees, you know, where I raft, there's no trees.
It's harder around a rock.
The single point anchor, it does work. But I think a lot of people are spoon fed that information. Wrap three, pull two. Yes, it does work. A lot of people don't understand why it works.
It's got good rhythm to it too. Wrap three, pull two. I mean, something you remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so easy to just throw a webbing around a rock. And webbing's strong. Like, we're not usually worried about with webbing breaking. Mark, when we did all the D-ring testing, did we do wrap three? We just did a simple simple loop of webbing around that tree.
No, we didn't. We did a wrap three pull two because remember I put a carabiner on the knot and it did actually tension up, but we did have it in situ.
No, but the knot wasn't the knot off on the side? Was it not against the tree or was it just on the side?
No, it was on. I can't remember.
I think we did a simple wrap and we were breaking things and we never had a problem with that webbing breaking.
I'm going to say, I think this one's less important though. If you're doing a wrap three pull two, or you're doing a simple wrap.
I'm going to go ahead and get to a one. We have a lot to go through, guys, just so you know.
Oh,
I took there was a quote in here that I think I took out. Here we go. Read this quote. This was in the email somebody sent me a few weeks ago, and it's anecdotal. It's one person, but I feel like an issue with our rescue courses is we spend way too much time on some things.
Yeah.
Like wrap three, pull two, when we could just say, hey, throw some webbing around it. It's going to be fine. That's my opinion. But
that's the best argument I've heard. Zach, that's a great argument for not. I don't think it's necessary, and I agree with you.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. Okay. Foot entrapment training. The winner here, and it's very, you can see it's very divisive. All those other tiny little things were people like sharing their opinions about this. But you know, the choices were two bank rope rescue, single bank rope rescue, wading and swimming, using available boats. The question is, what should the training focus on? Not what's the best technique. Like, if you're going to go practice something in training, what should you focus on? Do you guys have any opinions on this? I think you asked about foot entrapment training earlier, Aaron.
Yeah. I'm just going to take a stance here for a second and ask this question. It's like, do we even need to teach foot entrapment in river safety training classes?
I would say yes.
Like, I look at all the things that I've dealt with over the years. Have you guys been on a trip where someone's been foot entrapped? You, Mark, has. Okay. I've never seen it. I've heard of it randomly, and the spots where I've heard about it was where someone was underwater and you couldn't even get to them. You know, and so actually, I was on a trip where a guy said he did for a bit, but I don't.
I wasn't a trip where it happened. It happened on a side hike up the Clavey once, and they were able to get hands on her, like they were able to get in the water and get hands on the Clavey River, and then like spent some time wiggling around and got her out.
How about you, Mark? What was yours?
Mine was actually, I took a swim myself once, and it was a pretty nasty swim in Nepal, and I went over a feature. I had time. My feet were literally just under the surface, and literally momentarily for a second, I felt my foot getting stuck, and I managed to, you know, yank my foot quickly, which was quite scary. I've seen it in Australia when I was rafting in Australia. And when we teach foot entrapment now, and this is where we get the difference between the emergency services and the whitewater rescue community, is that I teach just get your hands on them, get to them quick, and get an airway. And I also talk a little bit about, you know, somebody that's foot entrapped, we're going to try and approach them so that you don't become entrapped with them. So a little bit of self, you know, taking care of yourself. But for me, foot entrapment now is in a river, in a whitewater with them, a group of boaters. It's get your hands on them, get that airway up. And, you know, we look in the manuals and we see all these fancy cinches and double bank accesses and rope systems. Unless you're working with a team that practices this stuff day in, day out, unless you're on a river with a group of people that know the same techniques, it's never going to work. So for me, it's just get out there, get your hands on them, and get an airway.
And so, Aaron, I'm going to answer a question just to follow up with Mark. I've watched Mark teach it, and I really like what he does. He doesn't like, he has people stuck on rocks out in the river, nothing crazy. And it's more teaching how to move in the whitewater environment than anything else. It's like, hey, how do we get hands on this person, pull them upstream, and then just like a little bit of practice with like a one bank rescue throw technique. But it's like, it's more about moving in the whitewater world, which you need for just like boats that are stuck. You need it for like, yeah,
no, that all makes sense. And I think that the going out with a group of people makes sense, practicing things like that, depending on the side, like quickly you've got numbers. I just go back to our original conversation about what's the low hanging fruit. What are people dying from on rafting trips? How many people are dying from foot entrapments, or would have died from a foot entrapment if they hadn't been rescued, or if they, you know, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense.
There aren't that many fatalities by foot entrapments. My take is, if somebody's foot entrapped, you need to be able to do something.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't happen very often, but boy, would it be embarrassing if you had no training and we don't know what to do. And so just some training about like, and like, I like the way Mark describes it. Like, just get hands on them, like get out there and get hands on them. And like, don't worry about all these like complicated rope systems, which are good for firefighters. But like, and Mark, you said yesterday too about that. We talked about this yesterday. A lot of times swiftwater rescue is doing body recovery. So their two bank systems are about body recovery, not about keeping somebody's airway up.
Yeah. And then,
So I'm a big fan of like using the foot entrapment or just even body entrapment. Like Mark's done, it's like not just foot entrapment, somebody's body is just stuck or they're stuck on a rock. Let's practice moving through this whitewater environment through like shallow water wading and swimming to access the person, get hands on them, and then try to pull them off. And then afterwards, like holding on their PFDs and like helping them swim down to shore, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in agreement. And
Here's my favorite topic. Okay, here we go. If you find yourself floating towards a tree or other strainer, your best course of action is to do what?
Ooh.
Mark knows how I feel about this. What do you think the right answer is?
No, here? Zach, I know how you feel about this. I've had to listen to you talk about it on the phone many times. You just go off about this over and over and over again. And I'll say is like, I think this question is a poorly written question. I know what you're getting at. I know what you're trying to do, but I think you have a good point within this though. And I think we should not spend too much time on the question and more on the topic of how much time you spend practicing swimming over strainers versus how much time you spend practicing swimming to avoid strainers. And you should spend more time practicing swimming to avoid strainers and practicing to swim over strainers for sure. And I think Zach, you would argue that you should never even practice swimming over a strainer, which we can get into that. That's I think that gets farther down the line. But I think we both agree that's more important to teach people to avoid strainers is the priority.
Yeah. Right? And like I was on the river a bunch this summer and took photos of strainers that I saw. This is what a strainer looks like. It's not a pipe. This is just an example of a strainer, right? If you swam away from it, you're going to get to a better part of it, whether you go towards shore or towards the middle of the river. But you're not swimming over that strainer. Like there's tons of branches and bark and like, and what happens is if you teach people to swim over strainers, they see a strainer, like they can't distinguish between when you can and can't swim over. If you were above this, you're like, oh, there's a strainer. Let me swim towards it and over it. Well, that's just not going to happen. So I think that we're like encouraging people to do something that's very hard to do.
Can you actually
make that decision from the river? You're in the river looking down, your head's just above the water. You see a log, you can actually analyze it and go, oh, that's one I can swim over. Why don't I swim towards it instead of away from it?
I think there's Charlie Munger. Do you know who Charlie Munger is?
Yeah.
Was right. He talked about how in business schools they talked about this one, they would do this one type of analysis because it was really, he was gonna go get a surgery done. And this one hospital does this one surgery in the one way, and they say, well, we do it this way, even though it's not the best way, because it's easy to teach. And I think this is an easy thing for swiftwater courses to teach. It's an easy structured lesson. And it doesn't make sense to do it, but it's an easy one to teach. You have your plastic tube out there, you go out in the water, everyone gets in the water, practices swimming over it, and it's an easy activity to teach. And that's why it gets done. Not because it makes sense, not because it's that useful, but because it's easy to teach and to do.
And people say, well, it was great to do because I learned about the power of the river. I can teach about the power of the river different ways.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is like 63% of the people answered the way that I don't agree with. The way that I even worded weird on purpose to make people answer the way I wanted to.
But yeah, I think what you worded is like, that's what their understanding of the, and that's what the instruction says. And that's, you know, and like, hey, you should try to avoid it. And if you can't, swim headfirst towards it.
Which, again, from the river, you're up to here. There's a piece of wood. You can't make that analysis. Generally, yeah.
Try to swim away from it until the last minute you can't, and then you turn and swim towards it at the last second.
I think what they're teaching is like, oh no, actually look at the log, make a decision, and if you think you can get over it, start swimming towards it.
That's not what they say, Zach. They don't say if you think you can get over it, swim towards it. It's if you can't avoid it, swim towards it.
That's not what I'm hearing. Like my students, that when I go, hey, what happens if you see a strainer on the river? You swim towards it and over it. That's what I'm getting answers from students.
Another
way, doing the strainer swim is one way of teaching somebody to deal with a strainer is if you are stuck against the strainer, you know, swim towards it head first. There's other ways, you know, swim on it defensively, get your feet flat on it and try and walk to the end. That is another way. Would that work? No. What I'm against is raft guides telling customers, try and swim away from the wood, but if you do, get on your front and swim over it.
And that's where we're at now.
And hearing that in a safety demonstration given by a raft guide makes my skin crawl.
Hey, Mark, say what you prefer, what's your preference? To say.
My preference is that if you're in the water, get to the side, and there's wood, just get to the side, get out. As a guide, you want to be looking at how is that person, what are you doing to put that person in the water in the first place near wood? If you're running a commercial river that's being run on a daily basis with a known strainer as an operator, why are you not getting in there with a chainsaw and getting that wood out if it's posing a threat to life?
Yeah.
On a run, there's a million and one steps that can be taken before you even get to having to tell your customers how to swim over strainers.
So yeah. This question is about safety talks. Basically, should guides tell passengers if they can't avoid the log, to swim over it.
I wish, Zach, I wish you just said, if you're in a safety talk, would you rather, is it better to say, hey, you should swim to avoid strainers, or you should tell them be swim headfirst towards them to climb over them? I wish you'd just give them those two options. Like, do you teach them one or you teach them the other? And well, just say which, because then that would prove your point that most people think you should be teaching them to jump over the thing.
Well, I can do that question next. But my point is 57% are saying we should be telling our passengers if they can't avoid a log to swim over it. That's insane to me. Like,
But liability wise, you telling me liability wise, you just tell people to avoid it and then they can't avoid it. They go feet first towards it and they drown. You haven't told them what to do if they're going to.
I tell them in my talks, this is what we should be telling people in safety talks. If you see, if you're swimming to see wood below you, I want you to turn away from it and actively swim away from it towards, like, so you don't, like, get away from it.
Swim upstream.
Not upstream. I actually point this out in my talk. This is the log and you're swimming down to it. I want you to turn 90 degrees and aggressively swim away from it.
And what happens if you can't avoid it?
You're not swimming over it. I mean, honestly, you'll probably just go under it and be fine because people go under logs all the time. But like to explain to somebody who's not a river person to make a decision. Oh, you need to make a decision about whether this one's safe or not safe to swim over, and then have them swim towards it, I think is more dangerous.
I don't disagree with what you're saying. I agree on one sense, but I think it's going back to like kind of like with the foot entrapment of you need to tell them what to do if they're in that situation where they couldn't avoid it. Because you don't want to, after the fact, this is my concern, to be like, well, the log was all the way across the river. I'm in the middle of the river. They told me to avoid it. I couldn't avoid it.
Yeah, but people are not swimming over strainers. I mean, it's like such a small percentage of strainers.
I think I look at that strainer you took a photo of. I'm like, yeah, I could swim over. I may not swim all the way over it, but I could keep my head up above it and keep my head above and not go under that one for sure.
I mean, you could stand up above it too. It's shallow water.
But look
at all those like branches on it. I mean, it's just what trees look like.
Oh, no, that's
this isn't even a bad one.
But that's why you don't want to go underneath it, because then there's a bunch of branches underneath, and you're just like, are you going to make it underneath it?
Oh, for sure. You might, but you're not making it over that one either. You can make it, you can swim away from it and get around the end. Anyway, I'm not going to debate this anymore. I'm not going to die. I'm kind of done dying on the sword. This has become a problem for me because when I teach people in courses, I ask in a safety talk for like private boaters, just by the way, if you guys see a tree, what should you do? And I'm trying to engage them in that kind of safety talk. And they say, I've heard enough times this spring, if you see a tree, get on your stomach and swim towards and over it. And I just don't even have an answer for that. I'm like, why do you think that?
Well, But then Zach, I think that's why if you put that question in there, like, hey, just do that question. And if you have that data, I think it's going to be make you a lot stronger argument for it. If most people, if 60% of people, if you give them option of, hey, if you see a strainer, are you A, supposed to swim to avoid it, or B, swim headfirst over it? And most people say B, then I think you're just going to have a strong argument to get rid of it totally. That's my point. I see your problems with it and I agree with the problem.
Okay, Mark Halder has a question for you. How much time do you spend on a strainer swim during a course?
Well, if I'm working in the same country you live in, Halder, I'm doing zero. I teach something else because obviously Haldor's in Iceland. I live in Iceland. There's no trees in Iceland. I will spend – it is a very quick session. I would say that including – scenarios and multiple run scenarios, the session, depending on the amount of students, is no more than 20-30 minutes, if that.
And how long is the course, say?
So if we're doing a Rescue 3 WRT in Europe, it's an 18-hour course.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful.
Mark and I talked about this morning, and we're about to do this rescue instructor course. And the idea I presented was like, let's take our swimmer dummy on the river with us, and let's let him float into strainers and observe what happens to them. And if they get stuck, perform some sort of rescue. Like, that's a good use of time.
I'm very much very keen into teaching rescues of people off strainers than I am going through that whole drill of having somebody sat against the strainer. And again, also just a tip that we did. So when we're teaching rescue in Europe, within Rescue 3 Europe, we have our accident reporting system, and most of the water related accidents on training courses were strainer swims, where instructors are setting up artificial strainers in high energy water, and it's a plastic pipe or it's something inflatable that's bouncing on the top of the water, and as the person goes to swim over it, they get said strainer in the face. So part of what we've just done in our instructor updates in Europe is looking at how we run strainer sessions and bringing it back to way lower energy water than some of these ones. And you know, the strainer picture on a rescue course for those people that are running courses commercially, and you know, people that are looking to book a rescue course, they want to put themselves in that position where they can feel the power of the river. So having that picture of somebody stuck against the strainer for some people is a key selling point of the course.
I mean, people, it looks cool on social media. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's easy. It's an easy thing to teach and to do with the students.
This goes back to foot entrapments too. Like, they're both. How many commercial rafting guests do you know that got stuck in strainers?
Not that many.
I think one put in on the South Fork a long time ago when we were in college. Remember, across from Chili Bar, but I think it was like a bushy, brushy one. It wasn't like a log across the river. It was one that
there's not an epidemic of people getting stuck in strainers. Now, if you look at the accident database, strainer comes up a lot, but it's usually like a kayak is pinned against it, a raft gets stuck on it, somebody swims to shore and they grab the brush and get stuck in this brush. It's not like you've fallen above a strainer and then you swim into it and die. That's not like a thing that's happening that often. So it's like sort of like, it's like foot entrapment. It's like, it's not very common. My take is we should talk about it, but it's not worth spending a ton of time on. There's better, more valuable things. And setting up a strainer drill takes time. All right, let's move on. This is one: when swimming, river guides should be use a combination of aggressive and defensive swimming.
Yeah, great.
Mark and I taught a course, and one of the guides said, "Oh, my instructor told me I should only swim aggressively." And Mark was like, "No, you can't. It's not possible." But Mark, you know, and luckily most people agree, but there's one instructor out there teaching people to only swim aggressively. Hopefully they're seeing this. Carabiners on the outside of your PFD. Also, a lot of opinions, like all those little small ones are just people writing opinions. 50% say a bit weird, just put them in your pockets. 18% nice to have, and 9% saying critical for quick rescues. Like, got to have them so you can do a quick rescue.
What quick rescue do you need to use a carabiner? If it's a quick rescue, you're going to get somebody freaking hands on them.
We're rescued.
And going back to swimming over logs, if you have carabiners on that side of your PFD and an external knife, it's much harder to swim over logs. So this is just making it hard to swim over things.
You know, maybe it's easier to clip yourself into the raft when you're coming back in. Maybe
that's the strainer.
The strainer. Yeah, either one. You can just clip yourself in there so you don't go under the strainer.
I moved on to knots, and I brought this quote up.
Just so we're clear, carabiner should not be on the outside of your life jacket, right? That seems like an obvious.
I mean, 50% of people are saying that, but
if it is only 50% though, which is crazy to me with the other stuff that we get 60% plus on some other stuff.
Well, actually, like all those little lines are people writing an answer. So like you see somebody wrote cumbersome, dangerous. So like there's people wrote in answers that were went all over the map. So it's probably like 55%.
if you do have to have one, it needs to be probably an auto locker, and whatever it's attached to needs to be something that releasable. It can release from. So you know, the amount of people that go out and buy a PFD from Europe or a Palm PFD, and you've got the little plastic D that you can clip a carabiner to, and they say, "Oh, it's broken." No, it's supposed to be there in case it gets snagged. I remember you doing that.
I was one of those people. Why is this D ring broken? Yeah, that was me. All right. So let's talk about knots. I think my take is we're teaching too many knots, and we're not teaching the right knots, because guides need other knots than just like the rescue ones. And so here we're asking the minimum knots people should know. Trucker's hitch, which guides use all the time, but isn't taught in rescue classes. Water knot, I think, is an important one. Figuring a bite, you can see the high percentage ones. And bowline. So like trucker's hitch, water knot, figuring a bite, and bowline. If you just knew those knots, would you be fine?
For me, it's a knot that gives you a loop in the end of the rope, a loop in the middle of the rope, something to tie around, so a hitch, something to tie two ropes together. And here's an interesting one with the no knot. And with the equipment moving on all of the time, a lot of people are now carrying webbing, flip lines with terminal ends, with a loop in the ends. Yeah. So people are clipping it together. So people are not tying no knots anymore, because everybody's got, there we go, everybody's got fancy flip lines with loops that can be clipped together. So I can, if people keep going this way where we're using lightweight equipment, I can see in time to come for river runners, the water knot is I would say it's never going to become obsolete, but people are not going to use it because they're using these flip lines.
I mean, you need it for a three-point anchor, which I think we all agree is important for a three-point anchor on D-rings. And so you need a water knot there.
If you're using a webbing.
That's true.
What would you use instead where you wouldn't need it for a three-point anchor?
Bow line.
I use a bow line, or I use a throwback.
And then you're just making a figure eight.
So I'm going to use the loop on the end of my throwback and an Alpine butterfly, and I clip those two together.
And then shouldn't there be one more? Don't you need one more?
And then there's your external line, if you're using an external line that comes into it. Yeah.
So I my take is a lot of rescue instructors teach way too many knots, and people can't remember them all. Like you can remember, like you can learn four or five knots in a few hours, and then you have to actually use them in the real world to remember them. If you learn a knot in a class and you don't use it again, you won't remember it. And I feel like I've seen instructors teach the Alpine butterfly and the directional eight.
No.
Like they both do the same thing. Why are you learning two complicated knots?
Zach, this is going back to the show you did when we spoke about, you know, what is the instructor? And when we talk about instructors, teaching knots and teaching MA gives the instructor a chance to puff their chest out and say, "Hey, look at me. I know all of these knots."
Yeah.
And they want to impart, they want to force themselves onto the students and teach all of these knots. At the end of the day, it's like I just said, it's a loop, the middle of the loop, it's around something, not even names, just that's what you do.
So most of the knots here, I look at, like the ones that are higher on the end, like trucker's hitch, yep, use all the time. Water knot, yep. Figure on a bite, yep. You know, and then you're like, okay, the bowline, yeah, not as much as the other ones, but still helpful. Clove hitch, do I really need to know clove hitch?
I use it for tying tarps up. That's about
and the
it.
Taut, and the taut line hitch. Yeah, the taut line hitch and the clove hitch are like, we're talking for rescue here, like the trucker's hitch for rescue too.
It's not a rescue knot. Like,
what?
I wouldn't say the trucker's hitch and rescue knot, but no. This, I think we've been talking about rescue a lot. I'm just saying all, like, what are the knots river guides should know beyond just the rescue knots? And I feel like rescue instructors are teaching all these rescue knots, and they're forgetting river guides need to know how to tie a boat to a tree, and how to like tie the rope up so it's like on the end of the raft, and tie some bags down.
That's where you've got the distinction, Zach, is that there's a lot of river guides will go on a rescue course and learn knots for rescue, and then river guides will go and do a guide school where there's your everyday knots, which is your taut line hitch, your clove hitch, and stuff like that. So there's definitely knots that you want to know for rescue, and then there's knots that you want to know for your everyday rough guiding business.
So here I asked a different question, asked in a different way, and 44%, you know, they had the longest list, like, which included both an alpine butterfly and a directional eight.
And a clove hitch. Wow.
And a clove hitch and a double fisherman's, which you only need to make a prusik, which are pre-sewn anyway now. And you don't have to know it. You can just watch YouTube and tie it at home. Like, teaching that in a class is insane. Where, like, you can get a lot done with a figure and a bite, a water knot, and a prusik hitch. You add an alpine butterfly to that, you're in business. So, I don't know. I feel like there's too much emphasis on knots. This is my opinion. I would say knots guys need to know taut line on the hitch. The next one is a way to tie a boat to shore, which I think this Mark calls this the $1 million yacht knot. Tying, like, I just use taut line hitch, but round turn two half hitches works. Two half hitches work. I don't know. There's a lot of choices. Steve Welch and I got in a huge argument about this. Actually, he feels like round turn two half hitches is a standard. Anyway,
what's the round turn part? That
you just wrap it around once and then you do the two half hitches,
like a full around all the way around.
Yeah. So if it's a big tree, it's hard to do something. Exactly. I know. Whatever. That's why I'm like taut line hitch. You and Steve can argue about it later. A way to store the knot.
I do three half hitches just to make myself feel a little safer.
A taut line hitch. Three half hitches. A taut line hitch.
It's a little different.
Okay, whatever. I'm not gonna get into it right now. Rope storage knot, which we use the rope storage knot. Mark would say it's a dangerous way to wrap up your rope because it's an entrapment, which it is. Mark would say the gas hitch, but a way to like take care of your rope with the end bounce your bow lines.
What's the gas hitch, Mark?
It is you're gonna coil your it's hard to explain. You're gonna coil your
it's
rope.
It's hard to explain.
You're going to feed half of it underneath. And then we did it when I did your original course.
Yeah. I know that one.
It's okay, really good. I wish I was a better person and used it more. Mark, this week I'm going to be a better person. And
why
use
is the gas hitch? I don't think that, but
there's no like loops you can get a hand or foot dangling.
Yeah. But then what's nice about what I prefer about the rope storage knot to the gas hitch is if I need to hop out and grab the boat quick and you got that little bit of line on there, just enough. That you can like grab it. You can have the person in the bow line, hey, hop out and grab that boat, and they can grab it. And there's enough there for them to grab it.
And Mark would say use your perimeter line for that.
Yeah, maybe.
There's pros and cons. We're not getting into it. Basic knots list is a list of things guides need to know, right? I think truckers hitch a bow line mainly to tie bags down or tie rafts on a trailer or whatever. But like, that's a basic list guy should know. And then rescue knots, I feel like we can limit it to that list. And
why do you need the clove hitch?
You don't. I could take it off. You're right. I put it on
there. The rescue knots potentially maybe the no knot and a friction hitch, Munter or in Italian.
I love the Munter.
I don't ever use it.
Oh, man. I found so many places to use it over the years. You're just Yeah.
The Munter in an external system for the progress capture works, and then a no knot if we're going rescuey, I mean that's kind of going down the emergency services route. But yeah, a no knot as a downstream anchor on something you want to release quickly, that works.
You mean no knot like wrap it around a tree a bunch of times? That no knot
Okay.
Anyway, this is like. Instead of teaching a zillion knots, let's keep it to at most this. This like maybe add no knot, maybe add the Munter.
I agree. Get rid of the clove hitch. Keep it to four.
If you want to take an advanced class, let's go nerdy on knots. But if you're just there to be a better, safer, more responsible boater, this is a solid list of knots, and it's still a lot to remember.
It's like the people who don't like math, like. There's, I think, people who like knots, and they're going to know a ton of knots. And I think the three of us, we love knots. You can tell we're like, and they'd be like, I don't like them. I don't want to. Like, okay, learn these four, and you can use these four.
Do almost everything.
Everything you need, and keep
All right, tying a raft to shore. This is one that blew my mind. 33% are saying use the bowline. That is arguably wrong.
The bowline. I thought it's clove hitch. Oh, different green.
The preferred knot for tying a raft or tree to a tree rock is the bowline. Like a bowline can work its way loose.
It's just what's historically been done, and it's just been fed down through the generations. And, you know, if you ask these people, why are you tying a bowline? It's my father done it. It's the way we've always done it. It's the way it's done. And that's just a generation. I don't do it. I don't even teach a bowline on classes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not it's a nice knot to have to attach a rope to something, but it can come loose. It can, like, jiggle loose.
People get it wrong too much as well.
The other problem with the bowline is if you have a long 50-foot rope and you're only tying to a tree 10 feet away, you can't get to feed the whole thing through. So, like, my answer here is tautline hitch on a bite. Mark and Steve would say round turn 2 half-hitches.
And Aaron, I would just say 2 half-hitches, maybe 3.
Yeah, I 3 is a tautline hitch, dude.
No, it's not exactly, because the taut line is different. You do 2 above and then you do 1 below in a taut line, right?
Oh, you do 1 above, 2 below?
No. I just 3 half-inches, I just do 1, another one below, another one below. 3 half-inches. That's not a taut line hitch. No, because my line's little short. I don't want to come out. I'll do a third one, then I don't have to worry.
I'm gonna say some member of the half hitch family.
Yeah.
2 half-hitches, tall and hitch, round turn 2 half-hitches, but it's going to be at a bite because you're going to have extra rope.
Yeah.
I
just like the ones where people make it complicated to untie it and they're doing something weird. Maybe it's the bowlines.
The bowlines are hard to untie.
Like a weird bowline with a bite or something like that. Maybe that's what's going on. Cause I'm like, I always come up to them like, dude, what did you tie here? What's going on here? This is not a, the half hitches are very easy, and same with the taut line, very easy to remove if you're doing someone else's boat. Yeah.
We did the IRF course up here this year, and we had one student, we put him on his trip leader scenario, and he had to tie a boat up to a tree, and you could see him with the rope in his hand, and I just watched his head just empty. He stood there, and he was like...
Poor guy.
Oh, what's happening here? He was like, which knot? And fair play to him at the end of it. He said, look, I've got to go downstream. I've got somebody to deal with. One of you guys tie this boat up here. So I was like, well done.
I forget that one. Let's get into it later. I would say, like, this is an important one. I think it should be taught in rescue classes.
Why?
I'll tell you why.
Rescue classes?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because it's important. And the example, because guides aren't good at this. Like, first of all, we're seeing 33% saying bowline. So the education is not getting out there. But this year in the subway, there was an incident above Ladle where a boat, somebody swam. They're doing CPR on somebody. People pulled their boat up on shore, didn't tie it up. The boat came loose. 2 people R2'd Pat to get the loose boat. They flipped. One of those people died. There's 2 deaths.
Oh.
And so, like, they didn't tie their boat up. And because they didn't tie the boat up, it went free. And people decided to chase it in an R2. So, and we see in IRF courses, like, people aren't tying their boats up properly and quickly. So I feel like, and then our students, like our private boater students, have no idea how to tie boats ashore. Like, it's a thing we are teaching them all the time, even if they've been through a rescue course. So I just think being able to secure your boat's important. That's why I'm bringing this up.
Wow. That's wow. I did not realize.
Read that accident report.
God.
Yeah. All right. We're getting done with this. We got to get done soon.
Yeah.
Mark and I are going kayaking. Okay. This is one, too. I feel like talking to Chris Davis about CPR, realizing CPR for drowning is not properly taught anywhere. And the point of this one is it should be taught in rescue courses. It's not being taught in CPR classes. It's not being properly taught in first aid or warfare courses.
Please explain.
So, like,
5 rescue breaths. It's the difference. So when we teach CPR for someone that's potentially having a cardiac arrest, we go straight into that 30 to 2. repetition. Whereas if it's a drowning person, we need to get those 5 rescue breaths in first.
They need oxygen, and then quickly.
So, I totally agree. I didn't know that.
And CPR is 30 and 2, and now they're not even teaching breaths in CPR.
Yeah, they start hammering on the chest first. They're all about hammering on the chest, and
drowning—that's not going to work.
No,
and also things like having people like going through it, and we've been doing a lot of this with our guides, like having a person with a PFD on, like going through the process of like removing the PFD, getting them on a flat surface, bringing the AED in, like whatever communication device you use, like going out, and then managing the group, being like, hey, by the way, you have a bunch of people. Do you want them there or not? Do you need to send somebody to manage the group? And so I feel like this is one of the most likely accidents we're going to have on a river, but it's not adequately covered anywhere. And so I think it should be moved into either rescue courses, or every organization needs to do training on this.
And then along with the drowning, you also have the near drownings that needs to really be discussed.
It'd be sweet to talk about that too.
I mean, you should talk about that as well, right? Because like that's almost worse in a weird way, is like, oh, the person's fine and then they're not fine.
I mean, the thing that we talk about is I don't want to go into first aid. And I think that's the fear of like rescue instructors, is they're not first aid instructors. So they're scared to broach this topic, but keeping it simple is good. The thing we talk about with near drowning is if you observe their breathing for like 5 hours, they can stay if they're good. Right. But if they're having problems breathing, you need to get them out of there quickly.
Yeah. I think both of those seem like topics that should be covered within the swift water river. That realm, just because then it's not covered well enough in wilderness first responder courses
at all. It's glazed over and barely covered. Yeah. And so, and then on the AED topic, this is just informational. We have AEDs in all of our trips now. That's just a choice I made, but thought this was interesting data. This is us doing training. If this will load, oops. I don't know how to play this, but this is us in how we did training. And I guess the video is not going to load right now, but like having them use like one of our raft floors to provide a CPR surface. We have a CPR dummy, and then using bag valve masks. There's many bag valve masks. I have one right here to provide more oxygen. So like there's this something this big you can bring on trips, and this will provide higher oxygen.
Bigger, Zach.
Oh, how do I make myself bigger? This is called a mini BVM, and it fits in this little thing. It pops open, and it's a way to use a bag to provide oxygen. People won't be tired. There's also a mask for this. People won't get tired of doing this the way they will doing breaths, and it provides higher oxygen. So just like little things like that, I think will be like are a big part of training. So on that, I have a CPR and drowning lesson plan that if anybody wants to see it, at the bottom of this video, you can click the link. It'll take you to a place you can like see this lesson plan we've worked on for our what we do with our guides and what I think should go into rescue courses personally. Hmm. All right.
So just to pause here for a second. As a guide, I would much prefer to have training on those last two topics we just talked about, drowning and near drowning, mm-hmm. than foot entrapments and strainers.
Yeah. If you look at the data, it's more important.
Yeah. And this is the classic. I think this is your point at the beginning, is like, what are we talking about and what aren't we talking about? And this is like, gosh, I mean.
So what I'm teaching at the moment, Aaron, is that I will do my entrapments. I'll do my entrapments, which leads me beautifully into, we call it casualty management, and it leads me beautifully into this section here. And the video that Chris did this year was an absolute game changer for me. When I'm doing course, every course I've done since watching that video, I've shared it with every student. Right. And I think that video was a game changer for me.
What video is this that you guys are talking about?
It's on the Gay Garage, and go on, Zach.
It's the last. So like this is, we're doing right now the professional guide series. That's what this is right now. It's the last one we did. It's off to send it to you. If you just Google like CPR Chris Davis, it'll come up.
Okay, thanks. No, I think everyone, so everyone can hear. Yeah.
He did one. We did one like this too, like during COVID, like 4 years ago. And then this one was updated and more succinct. And it's like the first one got a bazillion views and people were like super appreciative. This one's shorter and better. And I learned a lot. And it motivated me to like create this lesson plan and do more of teaching CPR to our guides.
Zach, can you just go back to your AED slide?
Yeah.
I think something's worth mentioning with the AEDs as well is that, is it Charlie Woolbridge? Is that the guy that does the thing? Is that I remember he did a talk for Baker and the guys down at Ace Rafting, and he said, you know, many years ago, the biggest killer on the rivers was entrapment, which led to drowning. Nowadays, because we're living, you know, a much more sedentary lifestyle, the heart attack is probably the number one killer on rivers. And I think people need to understand the difference between the reason you're taking an AED on the river is not potentially for a drowning victim, but it's for that victim that does no exercise, takes a long swim, and has a heart attack. Where I'm based in Iceland this year, we just did our first commercial death on rivers that have been rafted for over 20 years. And it was a heart attack. Could that have been saved with an AED? We don't know. So, yeah.
I mean, and the reason we have them on overnight trips is like, it could just be somebody, it's their time, right? Like they could just be in camp hanging out and have heart attacks. So like, it's something that we carry that can save. It's expensive and bulky, but I can save a life. All right, we're almost done. I know we have things to do. We're supposed to leave, Mark. Waste belt throw bags. I was happy with this answer. Like 40% say yes, everybody should have them. 30% say no. About 30% is like only on hard rivers. Mark, what do you think?
Carry them. It's part of your PRE.
Aaron, what do you think?
I really don't like worrying paddle boating because it's hard for me to slide down into the bottom of the boat. I catch it all the time.
Yeah, because you're always hiding in the bottom of the boat.
No, exactly. That's my one. That's seriously my one complaint about it. Is it keeps me from moving around the way I want to move around when I'm paddle boating.
You should try the 15 meter. The smaller one actually isn't that. The smaller, the 15 meter one we wear is not that bulky.
I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm not arguing that point. I also though it's like. I think it's a little bit river dependent.
Yep.
I like wearing them more on rivers where I'm in and out of my boat a lot and I'm doing a lot of scouting or moving around. And it's really nice to just have it with me. I don't have to worry about it. But like on the Grand Canyon, I'm not going to, when I see people wearing hip throw bags in the Grand Canyon, I'm like, what are you going to do with that? You know, I don't know. Yeah. I just like, maybe they have a reason for it, but I'm like, I don't have any idea how that would be useful. Maybe, I don't know. So
I forgot mine on my last Middle Fork trip and I felt naked. I was like, oh man. So I'm it's becoming a habit for me. And that's thanks to Mark. Mark's smiling because he knows it's thanks to him.
I think a lot of guides as well as they'll traditionally wear that waist throw belt. So the bag is on the bottom of the spine on the back. Whereas when I paddle guide, I'm a right-sided guide and I'll wear it on my left hip. So I can move around the boat. I can get up and down and I've got a full range of strokes on the right-hand side and it's out of the way.
Yeah. No, that's exactly. I just feel unathletic and that's, I'll try that sometime. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Next one whistle. I feel like I hear a lot of different things. I was happy to see most people say attention eyes on me, which I feel is the right answer. But 10% of people think a whistle means a swimmer or just something dangerous happening. But for me, it's like, if I blow whistles because I want attention, I will point out the danger. So I don't know. That's pretty straightforward. And then this one is, you can't see it, but I asked people to like rate things they thought were important and I've sort of summarized it here. And so there's a big tier jump.
Wow.
From high priority to low priority. Like the list on the high priority list was a pretty agreed on. And then a low priority list, it was way lower.
Zach, are you sure you didn't? Did you sandbag this? Did you like word it in a way? Because this looks like Zach's list. If Zach were to choose a list, is there anything on the low priority that you want on the high priority, Zach?
Mechanical advantage.
I
was surprised that was so low, honestly.
I Yeah.
I'd want wading techniques on the high priority. Or moving in shallow water.
That's what I say. Wading techniques. That's what I mean. I would put that in high priority too. And I'd probably put.
So what about wraps? Just in general, there's nothing about wraps.
I didn't put that. I should have put that there. Like managing pins would have been a good thing to put there.
But I like, it's interesting. The CPR on drowning is high on the list. And we were just talking about it. I think that's a really fascinating one. That's right there. It seems like people know what they need to work on.
What the priority should be. And I think rescue instructors need to see this because I think they're teaching a lot of the right side and ignoring a lot of the left side.
Yeah. Let's go down the left side real quick. And like in the Swiftwater courses, that aren't taught by Mark and Zach. Yeah, there's a fair amount of swimming, I think, most of them. I think that part does. But swimmer recovery.
Mark would disagree with you. How do you feel about American swimmers, Mark?
Oh, come on. I'm in the country. Can you at least do this when I'm in Europe? I think that it's not necessarily the swimmers. I think that a lot of instructors are not teaching swimming into enough detail and, you know, teaching good swimming, good defensive swimming, good swimming, because they're on a class that is, say, 18, 24 hours in total, and they're chomping at the bit to be able to teach the stuff that they know is going to take much more time, which is your knots, your rope work, your mechanical advantage, and which is what, if you ask any rescue class at the start of the rescue class, hey, welcome to the rescue class, what do you want to learn on this rescue class? The students are saying, we want to do rope work because that's what they think they need to do on a rescue class. And the instructor is trying to facilitate their needs by skipping through the really important stuff like swimming to be able to get to teaching them all the geeky rope work that makes the instructor look good.
And I'm going to, before I say anything, when Mark sees the level of swimming that we have in America in our classes, he's pretty frustrated all the time.
Well, this is the level of swimming in Zach's classes that Mark does with Zach.
No,
right?
No.
These are IRF courses with other guides.
Okay.
This is like other companies we go to. We do IRF courses for them, or guides come here from other companies. The level of swimming across the board is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Mark, or words in your mouth.
It's like, the amount of people, frustrated. The amount of guides that cannot swim with a paddle in the hand. And I know that, you know, we had this when we did your IRF class, Aaron, and you said, you know, paddles are disposable, but, you know, the amount of people that cannot swim with a paddle.
But I will say, Mark, that was something that I'd never done with students until I did that course with you. And now every course, we practice swimming with a paddle in our hand.
Yeah.
And like every time I teach a course now, I do that. And that was one of the coolest, there were a lot of cool things, but that was one of those, like the light bulb went off and I was like, dude, this is stupid that I haven't been teaching this for all these years. And so hopefully that'll become more of a standard is, you know, practice swimming with your paddle, which I think particularly for guide types too, it's just like, it adds another element to it, which is great, you know, and it makes it more challenging. And yeah.
How many times are you going to swim in a river compared to how many times are you going to set up a mechanical advantage system?
Oh yeah.
Well,
if you're Zach, you're going to swim in the river a lot of times and you're going to be setting up a lot of mechanical advantage systems. So it's hard to say, but.
Yeah. But the swimming is saving lives, usually. Your own life, because you're getting out of danger, or you're swimming to a person who needs help sometimes. The mechanical advantage is saving equipment.
Just being a guide who's happy in the water and being able to swim. I did a class in West Virginia in the spring, and at the end of it, you know, we all got round and we said, you know, what did we enjoy about the class? And the exact words that came out of one of the students was that I did a swimming session on the course, and the entire swim, the students got in the river and they all missed the swim. And these are all, you know, class four plus goalie guides, and they all got in the river and they all failed the swim. And I got in the river because they were swimming aggressively on the front and they missed eddies. They were tired. And I got out, I did the entire swim defensively on my back, and then we went back and we studied defensive swimming more. And one of the words the instructor, the guide said at the end of the course was, oh, this new style of swimming. And I'm like, it's not a new style of swimming, it's defensive swimming. It's what we've been doing for years.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, so that's what, what's been
my aggressive swimming comment come back, that question earlier, is because people are being hammered to aggressively swim.
Yeah. And again, one of the reasons why I'm here and I've got such a good, you know, the repertoire I have with Zach now is that, you know, people are not doing rescue classes because they don't want to invest 4 days of their time. They don't want to invest $200-$300 to go and do a rescue class where they're lumped in with the firemen who can't swim.
Yep.
So as a result of that, guides are not doing rescue classes, so their skills are not up to date, or it's a guide that did a guide school 20-30 years ago, and there's no requirements for them to maintain a rescue certificate, and their swimming skills are just not where they should be because they've had no input, no training since they did their guide school 10, 25, 6, 7 years ago.
No, that all is really true. Yeah, no, and I think the swiftwater community here in the States have kind of done a disservice in terms of mixing those, because they are, you're like, so much of stuff is just lame when you go with the firefighters. You're like, this is just, yeah, it's not really, and you're just like, yeah, swiftwater classes are kind of meh. So going to this list of high priority things, one thing I was going to say about the knots and stuff like that, and maybe you do this, Mark, now, but I just feel like in this day and age, you should be able to send people videos beforehand and be like, hey, practice your knots beforehand. We should not be spending, you need to know your knots when you get here. Like, it's just about practicing them and know them. And like we got more important things to cover. You can learn knots at home when we're not out there, and we have limited time to practice the swimming and those other things.
Does that work? Yep. I did my first rescue class in the UK in 1996, and they sent us out a manual. And they said, read the manual, practice the knots, because on the first day, there's a test at the end of the first day.
Ooh.
So he went out and did it religiously. So yeah, I always drop a link to animatedknots.com. That works. It's a good website, yeah.
I had the same conversation with Santi. He teaches rescue in Ecuador. And he said, he's like, I make people know their knots. If they show up, they don't know their knots, they can't take the class. Like, he was hardcore about it.
I like that in a way. It's like, this is expectation. Like, you need, because it's not, you just have to put the time in.
Yeah. All right, let's finish this up. I know we could talk about this slide forever, but I'm going to move on just to finish up. So just to summarize, I think I want better alignment, not necessarily agreement. I think alignment's important. And I feel like we have to have more conversations like this with key people who are river guides. I really believe that Whitewater Rescue is different than Swiftwater Rescue, and I like that terminology. And I want to see more river guides teaching rescue to river guides, not like kayakers teaching river guides, or like real river guides, not somebody who did a season on the South Fork, but people who have solid experience. And also like incorporate more CPR and drowning. Yep. Into, oh, I misspelled guide. I got to fix that. Good so journey. That's it, gentlemen. If anybody out there wants to add a question, we have about half a minute before we probably finish this bad boy up. Do you guys want to see my magic trick while we wait? Okay, that's fine. You don't have to.
Go ahead, Zach.
I've been working all summer.
Yes.
I can make
the ace. Is this a card trick? Okay, hey, you got to make yourself big, Zach, so we can
see. I'm going to make the ace of spades appear. And just have to trust me that these are shuffled. Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1, magic.
I can't tell what card it is.
It's the five of hearts. So no magic today.
You just hope you do it enough times. If you do it 52 times plus or there, at some point you'll get it right.
I almost did it there. I think I can actually
almost.
I was close. It was the ace of spades was close to that card. So I'm gonna shut this down. Thank you two for bringing your 3 decades of experience each to this conversation. If anybody has questions, put them in the comments. And we'll try to answer them. Or do you have comments? Just to add comments. Like, the conversation really continues, because I know a lot of people won't watch this live because we came up with this like an hour ago and we haven't promoted it. But if you're watching this later, throw a comment down there. Give us your thoughts. Like, it helps us learn. Like, you know, our opinions could be wrong. They're probably not, because we're all super smart, but they could be. And so share your thoughts, or just be like, yeah, we agree with you. That's cool. And yeah, I'm gonna shut this bad boy down.
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Zach.
Yep, cheers, guys.